We were. We have flowered in Bravus amongst these northern fogs, but we first took root in Valeria, amongst the wretched slaves who toiled in the deep mines beneath the 14 flames that lit the freehold's nights of old. Most mines are dank and chilly places, cut from cold, dead stone. But the 14 flames were living mountains with veins of molten rock and hearts of fire. So the mines of Old Valeria were always hot, and they grew hotter when the shafts were driven deeper, ever deeper. The slaves toiled in an oven. The rocks around them were too hot to touch. The air stank of brimstone and would sear their lungs as they breathed it. The soles of their feet would burn and blister, even through the thickest sandals. Sometimes, when they broke through a wall in search of gold, they would find steam instead, or boiling water, or molten rock. Certain shafts were cut so low that the slaves could not stand upright, but had to crawl or bend. And there were worms in that red darkness, too.
"Earthworms?" she asked, frowning.
"Fireworms. Some say they are akin to dragons, for worms breathe fire, too. Instead of soaring through the sky, they bore through stone and soil. If the old tales can be believed, there were worms amongst the 14 flames even before the dragons came. The young ones are no larger than that skinny arm of yours, but they can grow to monstrous size and have no love for men.
Did they kill the slaves?
Burnt and blackened corpses were oft found in shafts where the rocks were cracked or full of holes. Yet still the mines drove deeper. Slaves perished by the score, but their masters did not care. Red gold and yellow gold and silver were reckoned to be more precious than the lives of slaves, for slaves were cheap in the old freehold. During war, the Valerians took them by the thousands. In times of peace, they bred them, though only the worst were sent down to die in the red darkness.
Didn't the slaves rise up and fight?
Some did, he said. Revolts were common in the mines, but few accomplished much. The dragon lords of the old freehold were strong in sorcery, and lesser men defied them at their peril. The first faceless man was one who did.
"Who is he?"
Arya blurted, before she stopped to think. "No one," he answered. "Some say he was a slave himself. Others insist he was a freeholder's son, born of noble stock. Some will even tell you he was an overseer who took pity on his charges. The truth is, no one knows. Whoever he was, he moved amongst the slaves and would hear them at their prayers. Men of 100 different nations labored in the mines, and each prayed to his own god in his own tongue. Yet all were praying for the same thing. It was release they asked for, an end to pain. A small thing, and simple. Yet their gods made no answer, and their suffering went on. Are their gods all deaf? He wondered, until realization came upon him one night in the red darkness. All gods have their instruments, men and women who serve them, and help to work their will on earth. The slaves were not crying out to 100 different gods, as it seemed, but to one god with 100 different faces, and he was that god's instrument. That very night he chose the most wretched of the slaves, the one who had prayed most earnestly for release, and freed him from his bondage. The first gift had been given. Arya drew back from him.
He killed the slave.
That did not sound right.
He should have killed the masters.
He would bring the gift to them as well. But that is a tale for another day.
one best shared with no one. He cocked his head. And who are you, child?
No one.
A lie.
How do you know? Is it magic?
A man does not need to be a wizard to know truth from falsehood. Not if he has eyes. You need only learn to read a face. Look at the eyes, the mouth, the muscles here at the corner of the jaw, and here, where the neck joins the shoulders. He touched her lightly with two fingers. Some liars blink, some stare, some look away, some lick their lips. Many cover their mouths just before they tell a lie, as if to hide their deceit. Other signs may be more subtle, but they are always there. A false smile and a true one may look alike, but they are as different as dusk from dawn. Can you tell dusk from dawn?
Arya nodded, though she was not certain that she could.
Then you can learn to see a lie, and once you do, no secret will be safe from you.
Teach me.
She would be no one, if that was what it took. No one had no holes inside her.
She will teach you,
said the kindly man, as a waif appeared outside her door. Starting with the tongue of Bravus, what use are you if you cannot speak or understand? And you shall teach her your own tongue. The two of you shall learn together, each from the other. Will you do this?
Yes, she said,
and from that moment she was a novice in the house of black and white. Her servant's garb was taken away, and she was given a robe to wear, a robe of black and white, as buttery soft as the old red blanket she'd once had at Winterfell. Beneath it she wore small clothes of fine white linen, and a black undertunic that hung down past her knees. Thereafter she and the waif spent their time together, touching things and pointing, as each tried to teach the other a few words of her own tongue. Simple words at first, cup and candle and shoe, and then harder words, then sentences. One Syrio Forel used to make Arya stand on one leg until she was trembling. Later he sent her chasing after cats. She had danced the water dance on the limbs of trees, a stick sword in her hand. Those things had all been hard, but this was harder.
Even sawing was more fun than tongues, she told herself, after a night when she had forgotten half the words she thought she knew, and pronounced the other half so badly that the waif had laughed at her. My sentences are as crooked as my stitches used to be.
If the girl had not been so small and starved, Arya would have smashed her stupid face. Instead, she gnawed her lip.
Too stupid to learn, and too stupid to give up.
The common tongue came to the waif more quickly. One day, at supper, she turned to Arya and asked,
Who are you?
No one, Arya answered in bravosi.
You lie, said the waif. You must lie gooder.
Arya laughed.
A gooder? You mean better, stupid.
Better, stupid, I will show you.
The next day they began the lying game, asking questions of one another, taking turns. Sometimes they would answer truly, sometimes they would lie. The questioner had to try and tell what was true and what was false. The waif always seemed to know. Arya had to guess. Most of the time she guessed wrong.
How many years have you?
The waif asked her once in the common tongue.
10,
said Arya, and raised 10 fingers. She thought she was still 10. It was hard to know for certain. The Bravasi counted days differently than they did in Westeros. For all she knew, her name day had come and gone. The waif nodded. Arya nodded back, and in her best Bravasi said,
How many years have you?
The waif showed 10 fingers, then 10 again, yet again, then 6. Her face remained as smooth as still water.
She can't be 36, Arya thought. She's a little girl.
You're lying,
she said. The waif shook her head and showed her once again 10 and 10 and 10 and 6. She said the words for 6 and 30 and made Arya say them too. The next day she told the kindly man what the waif had claimed.
She did not lie, the priest said, chuckling. The one you call waif is a woman grown who has spent her life serving him of many faces. She gave him all she was, all she ever might have been, all the lives that were within her.
Arya bit her lip.
Will I be like her?
No, he said, not unless you wish it. It is the poisons that have made her, as you see her.
Poisons?
She understood then. Every evening after prayer, the waif emptied a stone flagon into the waters of the Black Pool. The waif and kindly man were not the only servants of the many-faced god. From time to time others would visit the house of black and white. The fat fellow had fierce black eyes, a hooked nose, and a wide mouth full of yellow teeth. The stern face never smiled. His eyes were pale, his lips full and dark. The handsome man had a beard a different colour every time she saw him, and a different nose. But he was never less than comely. Those three came most often, but there were others. The squinter, the lordling, the starved man. One time the fat fellow and the squinter came together. Uma sent Arya to pour for them.
When you are not pouring, you must stand as still as if you've been carved of stone,
the kindly man told her.
Can you do that?
Yes.
Before you can learn to move, you must learn to be still.
Cyrio Farrell had taught her long ago at King's Landing, and she had. She had served as Roose Bolton's cupbearer at Harrenhal, and he would flay you if you spilled his wine.
Good, the kindly man said. It would be best if you were blind and deaf as well. You may hear things, but you must let them pass in one ear and out the other. Do not listen.
Arya heard much and more that night, but almost all of it was in the tongue of Braavos, and she hardly understood one word in 10.
Still as stone, she told herself.
The hardest part was struggling not to yawn. Before the night was done, her wits were wandering. Standing there with a flagon in her hands, she dreamed she was a wolf, running free through a moonlit forest with a great pack howling at her heels.
Are the other men all priests?
She asked the kindly man the next morning.
Were those their real faces?
What do you think, child? She thought, no.
Is Jaqen H'ghar a priest, too? Do you know if Jaqen will be coming back to Braavos?
Who? He said, all innocence.
Jaqen H'ghar. He gave me the iron coin.
I know no one by this name, child.
I asked him how he changed his face, and he said it was no harder than taking a new name, if you knew the way.
Did he?
Will you show me how to change my face?
If you wish. He cupped her chin in his hand and turned her head.
Puff up your cheeks and stick out your tongue.
Arya puffed up her cheeks and stuck out her tongue.
There. Your face is changed. That's not how I meant. Jaqen used magic. All sorcery comes at a cost, child.
Years of prayer and sacrifice and study are required to work a proper glamour.
Years,
she said, dismayed. If it were easy, all men would do it. You must walk before you run. Why use a spell when mummer's tricks will serve?
I don't know any mummer's tricks either. Then practice making faces. Beneath your skin are muscles. Learn to use them. It is your face, your cheeks, your lips, your ears. Smiles and scowls should not come upon you like sudden squalls. A smile should be a servant, and come only when you call it. Learn to rule your face.
Show me how.
Puff up your cheeks,
she did.
Lift your eyebrows. No, higher.
She did that too.
Good. See how long you can hold that. It will not be long. Try it again on the morrow,
You will find a mirrorish mirror in the vaults. Train before it for an hour every day. Eyes, nostrils, cheeks, ears, lips. Learn to rule them all. He cupped her chin. Who are you?
No one.
A lie. A sad little lie, child. She found the mirrorish mirror the next day, and every morn and every night she sat before it, with a candle on each side of her, making faces.
Fool your face, she told herself, and you can lie.
Soon thereafter the kindly man commanded her to help the other acolytes prepare the corpses. The work was not near as hard as scrubbing steps for Weiss. Sometimes, if the corpse was big or fat, she would struggle with the weight. But most of the dead were old dried bones in wrinkled skins. Arya would look at them as she washed them, wondering what brought them to the black pool. She remembered a tale she had heard from old Nan about how, sometimes during a long winter, men who'd lived beyond their years would announce that they were going hunting.
And their daughters would weep, and their sons would turn their faces to the fire, she could hear old Nan saying. But no one would stop them, or ask what game they meant to hunt, with the snow so deep and the cold wind howling.
She wondered what the old Bravossi had told their sons and daughters before they set off for the house of black and white. The moon turned and turned again, though Arya never saw it. She served, washed the dead, made faces at the mirrors, learned the Bravossi tongue, and tried to remember that she was no one. One day the kindly man sent for her.
"Your accent is a horror," he said. "But you have enough words to make your wants understood, after a fashion. It is time that you left us for a while. The only way you will ever truly master our tongue is if you speak it every day from dawn to dusk. You must go."
"When?"
she asked him. "Where?"
"Now," he answered. "Beyond these walls you will find the 100 isles of Bravas in the sea. You have been taught the words for mussels, cockles, and clams, have you not?"
"Yes,"
she repeated them in her best Bravasi. Her best Bravasi made him smile.
"It will, serve. Along the wharf below the drowned town you will find a fishmonger named Brusco, a good man with a bad back. He has need of a girl to push his barrow and sell his cockles, clams, and mussels to the sailors off the ships. You shall be that girl. Do you understand?"
"Yes."
"And when Brusco asks, who are you?"
"No one."
"No, that will not serve outside this house." She hesitated.
"I could be salty from salt pans."
"As salty is known to Tenesio Teres and the men of the Titan's daughter. You are marked by the way you speak, so you must be some girl of Westeros, but a different girl, I think." She bit her lip.
"Could I be Cat?"
"Cat," he considered.
"Yes, Bravas is full of cats. One more will not be noticed. You are Cat, an orphan of King's Landing."
She had visited White Harbor with her father twice, but she knew King's Landing better.
"Just so. Your father was oar master on a galley. When your mother died, he took you off to sea with him. Then he died as well, and his captain had no use for you. So he put you off the ship in Bravas. And what was the name of the ship?"
"Nemeria,"
she said at once. That night she left the house of black and white. A long iron knife rode on her right hip, hidden by her cloak, a patched and faded thing of the sort an orphan might wear. Her shoes pinched her toes, and her tunic was so threadbare that the wind cut right through it. But Bravas lay before her. The night air smelled of smoke and salt and fish. The canals were crooked, the alleys crookeder. Men gave her curious looks as she went past, and beggar children called out words she could not understand. Before long,
She was completely lost.
"Sir Gregor,"
she chanted, as she crossed the stone bridge, supported by four archers. From the centre of its span, she could see the masts of ships in the Ragman's harbour.
Donson, Rafe the Sweetling, Sir Ilion, Sir Meron, Queen Cersei.
Rain began to fall. Arya turned her face up to let the raindrops wash her cheeks. So happy she could dance.
"Valar Morghulis," she said. "Valar Morghulis. Valar Morghulis."
Elaine. As the rising sun came streaming through the windows, Elaine sat up in bed and stretched. Gretchel heard her stir and rose at once to fetch her bedrobe. The rooms had grown chilly during the night. "It will be worse when winter has us in its grip," she thought. "Winter will make this place as cold as any tomb." Elaine slipped into the robe and belted it about her waist. "The fire is almost out," she observed. "Put another log on, if you would."
"As my lady wishes," the old woman said.
Elaine's apartments in the Maiden's Tower were larger and more lavish than the little bedchamber where she'd been kept when Lady Lysa was alive. She had a dressing room and a privy of her own now, and a balcony of carved white stone that looked off across the vale. Whilst Gretchel was tending to the fire, Elaine padded barefoot across the room and slipped outside. The stone was cold beneath her feet, and the wind was blowing fiercely, as it always did up here, but the view made her forget all that for half a heartbeat. Maidens was the easternmost of the Eyrie's seven slender towers, so she had the vale before her, her forests and rivers and fields all hazy in the morning light. The way the sun was hitting the mountains made them look like solid gold. So lovely. The snow-clad summit of the Giant's Lance loomed above her, an immensity of stone and ice that dwarfed the castle perched upon its shoulder. Icicles 20 feet long draped the lip of the precipice where Lysa's tears fell in summer. A falcon soared above the frozen waterfall. Blue wings spread wide against the morning sky. Would that I had wings as well. She rested her hands on the carved stone balustrade and made herself peer over the edge. She could see sky 600 feet below, and the stone steps carved into the mountain, the winding way that led past snow and stone all the way down to the valley floor. She could see the towers and keeps of the Gates of the Moon, as small as a child's toys. Around the walls, the hosts of Lords Declarant were stirring, emerging from their tents like ants from an anthill. If only they were truly ants, she thought. We could step on them and crush them. Young Lord Hunter and his levies had joined the others 2 days past. Nestor Royce had closed the gates against them, but he had fewer than 300 men in his garrison. Each of the Lords Declarant had brought 1,000, and there were 6 of them. Elaine knew their names as well as her own. Benadar Belmore, Lord of Strongsong, Simon Templeton, the Knight of 9 Stars, Horton Redfort, Lord of Redfort, Anya Wainwood, Lady of Iron Oaks, Gilwood Hunter, called Young Lord Hunter by all and sundry, Lord of Longbow Hall, and Yun Royce, mightiest of them all, the redoubtable Bronze Yun, Lord of Runestone, Nestor's cousin and the chief of the senior branch of House Royce. The 6 had gathered at Runestone after Lysa Aaron's fall, and there made a pact together, vowing to defend Lord Robert, the Vale, and one another. Their declaration made no mention of the Lord Protector, but spoke of misrule that must be ended, and of false friends and evil counsellors as well. A cold gust of wind blew up her legs. She went inside to choose a gown to break her fast in. Peter had given her his late wife's wardrobe, a wealth of silks, satins, velvets, and furs, far beyond anything she had ever dreamed. though the great bulk of it was far too large for her. Lady Eliza had grown very stout during her long succession of pregnancies, stillbirths, and miscarriages. A few of the oldest gowns had been made for young Lysa Tully of River Run, however, and others Gretchel had been able to alter to fit Elaine, who was almost as long of leg at 3 and 10 as her aunt had been at 20. This morning her eye was caught by a party-coloured gown of Tully red and blue, lined with vair. Gretchel helped her slide her arms into the belled sleeves and laced her back, then brushed and pinned her hair. Elaine had darkened it again last night before she went to bed. The wash her aunt had given her changed her own rich auburn into Elaine's burnt brown, but it was seldom long before the red began creeping back at the roots. And what must I do when the dye runs out? The wash had come from Tyrish, across the narrow sea. As she went down to break her fast, Elaine was struck again by the stillness of the area. There was no quieter castle in all the Seven Kingdoms. The servants here were few and old, and kept their voices down so as not to excite the young lord. There were no horses on the mountain, no hounds to bark and growl, no knights training in the yard. Even the footsteps of the guards seemed strangely muffled as they walked the pale stone halls. She could hear the wind moaning and sighing round the towers, but that was all. When she had first come to Eyrie, there had been the murmur of Elisa's tears as well, but the waterfall was frozen now. Gretchel said it would stay silent till the spring. She found Lord Robert alone in the morning hall, above the kitchens, pushing a wooden spoon listlessly through a big bowl of porridge and honey.
"I wanted eggs," he complained when he saw her. "I wanted 3 eggs, boiled soft, and some back bacon."
They had no eggs, no more than they had bacon. The area's granaries held sufficient oats and corn and barley to feed them for a year. But they depended on a bastard girl named Maya Stone to bring fresh foodstuffs up from the valley floor. With the Lord's declarant encamped at the foot of the mountain, there was no way for Maya to get through. Lord Belmore, first of the 6 to reach the gates, had sent a raven to tell Littlefinger that no more food would go up to the area until he sent Lord Robert down. It was not quite a siege, not as yet, but it was the next best thing. "You can have eggs when Maya comes, as many as you like," Elaine promised the little lordling. "She'll bring eggs and butter and melons, all sorts of tasty things." The boy was unappeased.
"I wanted eggs today."
"Sweet Robin, there are no eggs, you know that. Please eat your porridge, it's very nice." She ate a spoonful of her own. Robert pushed his spoon across the bowl and back, but never brought it to his lips.
"I'm not hungry," he decided. "I want to go back to bed. I never slept last night. I heard singing. Maester Coleman gave me dream wine, but I could still hear it."
Elaine put down her spoon. "If there had been singing, I should have heard it too. You had a bad dream, that's all."
"No, it wasn't a dream."
Tears filled his eyes.
"Marillion was singing again. Your father says he's dead, but he isn't."
"He is." It frightened her to hear him talk like this. "Bad enough that he is small and sickly. What if he is mad as well?" "Sweet Robin, he is. Marillion loved your lady mother too much and could not live with what he'd done to her. So he walked into the sky." Elaine had not seen the body, no more than Robert had, but she did not doubt the fact of the singer's death. "He's gone, truly."
"But I hear him every night, even when I close the shutters and put a pillow on my head. Your father should have cut his tongue out. I told him to, but he wouldn't."
"He needed a tongue to confess." "Be a good boy and eat your porridge," Elaine pleaded. "Please, for me."
"I don't want porridge."
Robert flung his spoon across the hall. It bounced off a hanging tapestry and left a smear of porridge upon a white silk moon.
The Lord wants eggs.
The Lord shall eat porridge, and be thankful for it, said Peter's voice behind them.
Elaine turned, and saw him in the doorway arch, with Maester Coleman at his side.
You should heed the Lord Protector, my lord,
the Maester said.
Your lord's bannermen are coming up the mountain to pay you homage, so you will need all your strength.
Robert rubbed his left eye with a knuckle.
Send them away. I don't want them. If they come, I'll make them fly.
You tempt me sorely, my lord, but I fear I promise them safe conduct, said Peter. In any case, it's too late to turn them back. By now they may have climbed as far as Stone.
Why won't they leave us be? Wailed Elaine. We never did them any harm. What do they want of us?
Just Lord Robert, him, and the veil, Peter smiled. There will be eight of them. Lord Nestor is showing them up, and they have Lynn Corbury with them. Sir Lynn is not the sort of man to stay away when blood is in the offing.
His words did little to soothe her fears. Lynn Corbury had slain almost as many men in duels as he had in battle. He had won his spurs during Robert's rebellion, she knew, fighting first against Lord John Arryn at the gates of Gulltown, and later beneath his banners on the Trident, where he had cut down Prince Lewin of Dawn, a white knight of the King's Guard. Peter said that Prince Lewin had been sorely wounded by the time the tide of battle swept him to his final dance with Lady Forlorn, but added, "That's not a point you'll want to raise with Corbury, though. Those who do are soon given a chance to ask Martell himself the truth of it, down in the halls of hell." If even half of what she had heard from Lord Robert's guards were true, Lynn Corbury was more dangerous than all six of the Lord's declarant put together.
"Why is he coming?" she asked. "I thought the Corbrys were for you."
"Lord Lionel Corbury is well disposed toward my rule," said Peter. "But his brother goes his own way. On the Trident, when their father fell wounded, it was Lynn who snatched up Lady Forlorn and slew the man who cut him down, whilst Lionel was carrying the old man back to the maesters in the rear. Lynn led his charge against the Dornishmen, threatening Robert's left, broke their lines to pieces, and slew Lewin Martell. So when old Lord Corbury died, he bestowed the lady upon his younger son. Lionel got his lands, his title, his castle, and all his coin, yet still feels he was cheated of his birthright. While Sir Lynn, well, he loves Lionel as much as he loves me. He wanted Lysa's hand for himself.
I don't like Sir Lynn, Robert insisted. I won't have him here. You send him back down. I never said he could come, not here. The Eyrie is impregnable, Mother said.
Your mother is dead, my lord. Until your 16th name day, I rule the Eyrie.
Peter turned to the stooped-back serving woman, hovering near the kitchen steps.
Miller, fetch his lordship a new spoon. He wants to eat his porridge.
I do not let my porridge fly.
This time Robert flung the bowl, porridge and honey, and all. Peter Baelish ducked aside nimbly, but Maester Coleman was not so quick. The wooden bowl caught him square in the chest, and its contents exploded upward over his face and shoulders. He yelped in a most unmaester-like fashion, whilst Elaine turned to soothe the little lording, but too late. The fit was on him. A pitcher of milk went flying as his hand caught it, flailing. When he tried to rise, he knocked his chair backwards and fell on top of it. One foot caught Elaine in the belly, so hard it knocked the wind out of her. "Oh, God, be good," she heard Peter say, disgusted. Globs of porridge dotted Maester Coleman's face and hair as he knelt over his charge, murmuring soothing words. One gobbet crept slowly down his right cheek, like a lumpy grey-brown tear.
"It is not so bad a spell as the last one," Elaine thought, trying to be hopeful. By the time the shaking stopped,
two guards in sky-blue cloaks and silvery mail shirts had come at Peter's summons. "Take him back to bed and leech him," the Lord Protector said, and the taller guardsman scooped the boy up in his arms. "I could carry him myself," Elaine thought. "He's no heavier than a doll." Coleman lingered a moment before following.
My lord, this parley might best be left for another day. His lordship's spells have grown worse since Lady Lysa's death, more frequent and more violent. I bleed the child as often as I dare and mix him dream wine and milk of the poppy to help him sleep, but he sleeps 12 hours a day, Peter said. I require him awake from time to time.
The maester combed his fingers through his hair, dribbling globs of porridge on the floor.
Lady Lysa would give his lordship her breast whenever he grew overwrought. Archmaester Ebrose claims that mother's milk has many healthful properties.
Is that your counsel, maester, that we find a wet nurse for the Lord of the Eyrie and Defender of the Vale? When should we wean him? On his wedding day? That way he can move directly from the nurse's nipple to his wife's.
Lord Peter's laugh made it plain what he thought of that.
No, I think not. I suggest you find another way. The boy is fond of sweets, is he not?
Sweets, said Coleman.
Sweets. Cakes and pies, jams and jellies. Honey on the comb, perhaps a pinch of sweet sleep in his milk. Have you tried that? Just a pinch to calm him and stop his wretched shaking.
A pinch.
The apple in the maester's throat moved up and down as he swallowed.
One small pinch. Perhaps. Not too much. Not too often. Yes, I might try. A pinch,
Lord Peter said. Before you bring him forth to meet the lords.
As you command, my lord.
The maester hurried out, his chain clinking softly with every step.
Father, Elaine asked when he was gone, will you have a bowl of porridge to break your fast?
I despise porridge.
He looked at her with little finger's eyes.
I'd sooner break my fast with a kiss.
A true daughter would not refuse her sire a kiss. So Elaine went to him and kissed him, a quick dry peck upon the cheek, and just as quickly stepped away.
How dutiful!
Littlefinger smiled with his mouth, but not his eyes.
Well, I have other duties for you, as it happens. Tell the cook to mull some red wine with honey and raisins. Our guests will be cold and thirsty after their long climb. You are to meet them when they arrive and offer them refreshment.
Wine, bread, and cheese. What sort of cheese is left to us?
The sharp white and the stinky blue.
The white. And you'd best change as well.
Elaine looked down at her dress, the deep blue and rich dark red of Riveron.
Is it too?
It is too tully. The Lord's declarant will not be pleased by the sight of my bastard daughter prancing about in my dead wife's clothes. Choose something else. Need I remind you to avoid sky blue and cream?
No. Sky blue and cream were the colours of House Aaron.
8, you said. Bronzion is one of them?
The only one who matters.
Bronzion knows me, she reminded him.
He was a guest at Winterfell when his son rode north to take the Black. She had fallen wildly in love with Sir Waymar, she remembered dimly,
but that was a lifetime ago, when she was a stupid little girl.
And that was not the only time Lord Roy saw. He saw Sansa Stark again at King's Landing during the Hand's Tourney.
Peter put his finger under his chin.
That Royce glimpsed this pretty face, I do not doubt, but it was one face in 1,000. A man fighting in a tourney has more to concern himself than some child in a crowd. And at Winterfell, Sansa was a little girl with auburn hair. My daughter is a maiden, tall and fair, and her hair is chestnut. Men see what they expect to see, Elaine.
He kissed her nose.
Have Maddie lay a fire in the solar,
I shall receive our Lord's declarant there.
Not the High Hall?
No. Gods forbid they glimpse me near the high seat of the Aarons. They might think I mean to sit in it. Cheeks born so low as mine must never aspire to such lofty cushions.
The solar?
She should have stopped with that, but the words came tumbling out of her.
If you gave them Robert.
And the veil?
They have the veil.
Oh, much of it, that's true. Not all, however. I'm well loved in Gulltown, and have some lordly friends of mine own as well. Grafton, Linderley, Lionel Corbury. Though I grant you they're no match for the Lord Declarant. Still, where would you have us go, Elaine? Back to my mighty stronghold on the Fingers?
She had thought about that.
Geoffrey gave you Harrenhal. You are lord in your own right there.
By title. I need a great seat to marry Lysa, and the Lannisters were not about to grant me Casterly Rock.
Yes, but the castle is yours.
Ah, and what a castle it is! Cavernous halls and ruined towers, ghosts and draughts, ruinous to heat, impossible to garrison, and there's that small matter of a curse.
Curses are only in songs and stories.
That seemed to amuse him.
Has someone made a song about Gregor Clegane dying of a poisoned spear thrust? Or about the sellswords before him, whose limbs Sir Gregor removed a joint at a time? That one took the castle from Sir Aimery Lorch, who received it from Lord Tywin. A bear killed one, your dwarf the other. Lady Wentz died as well, I hear. Luston, Strongs, Harroways. Harrenhal has withered every hand to touch it.
Then give it to Lord Frey.
Peter laughed.
Perhaps I shall, or better still, to our sweet Cersei. Though I should not speak harshly of her. She is sending me some splendid tapestries. Isn't that kind of her?
The mention of the Queen's name made her stiffen.
She's not kind, she scares me. If she should learn where I am...
I might have to remove her from the game sooner than I'd planned, providing she does not remove herself first.
Peter teased her with a little smile.
In the Game of Thrones... Even the humblest pieces can have wills of their own. Sometimes they refuse to make the moves you plan for them. Mark that well, Elaine. It's a lesson that Cersei Lannister still has yet to learn. Now, don't you have some duties to perform?
She did indeed. She saw to the mulling of the wine first, found a suitable wheel of sharp white cheese, and commanded the cook to bake bread enough for 20. In case the Lord's declarant brought more men than expected.
Once they eat our bread and salt, they are our guests and cannot harm us.
The Freyers had broken all the laws of hospitality when they had murdered her lady mother and her brother at the Twins. But she could not believe that a lord as noble as Yon Royce would ever stoop to do the same. The solar next. Its floor was covered by a mirrorish carpet, so there was no need to lay down rushes. Elaine asked two serving men to erect the trestle table and bring up 8 of the heavy oak and leather chairs. For a feast she would have placed 1 at the head of the table, 1 at the foot, and 3 along each side, but this was no feast. She had the men arrange 6 chairs on one side of the table, 2 on the other. By now the Lord's declarant might have climbed as far as snow. It took most of the day to make the climb, even on muleback. Afoot, most men took several days. It might be that the lords would talk late into the night. They would need fresh candles. After Maddie laid the fire, she sent her down to find the scented beeswax candles Lord Waxley had given Lady Lysa when he sought to win her hand. Then she visited the kitchens once again, to make certain of the wine and bread. All seemed well in hand, and there was still time enough for her to bathe and wash her hair and change. There was a gown of purple silk that gave her pause, and another of dark blue velvet, slashed with silver, that would have woken all the colour in her eyes. But in the end she remembered that Elaine was, after all, a bastard, and must not presume to dress above her station. The dress she picked was lamb's wool, dark brown and simply cut, with leaves and vines embroidered around the bodice, sleeves, and hem in golden thread. It was modest and becoming, though scarce richer than something a servant girl might wear. Peter had given her all of Lady Lysa's jewels as well, and she tried on several necklaces, but they all seemed ostentatious. In the end she chose a simple velvet ribbon in autumn gold. When Gretchel fetched her Lysa's silvered looking-glass, the colour seemed just perfect with Elaine's mass of dark brown hair. "Lord Royce will never know me," she thought. "Why, I hardly know myself." Feeling near as bold as Peter Baelish, Elaine Stone donned her smile and went down to meet their guests. The area was the only castle in the Seven Kingdoms where the main entrance was underneath the dungeons. Steep stone steps crept up the mountainside past the Way Castle, stone and snow, but they came to an end at sky. The final 600 feet of the ascent were vertical, forcing would-be visitors to dismount their mules and make a choice. They could ride the swaying wooden basket that was used to lift supplies, or clamber up a rocky chimney using handholds carved into the rock. Lord Redfort and Lady Wainwood, the most elderly of the Lord's declarant, chose to be drawn up by the winch, after which the basket was lowered once more for fat Lord Belmore. The other lords made the climb. Elaine met them in the crescent chamber beside a warming fire, where she welcomed them in Lord Robert's name, and served them bread and cheese and cups of hot mulled wine in silver cups. Peter had given her a roll of arms to study, so she knew their heraldry, if not their faces. The Red Castle was Red Fort, plainly. A short man with a neat grey beard and mild eyes. Lady Anya was the only woman amongst the lords declarant, and wore a deep green mantle with the broken wheel of Wainwood picked out in beads of jet. 6 silver bells on purple. That was Belmore. Pear-bellied and round of shoulder. His beard was a ginger-grey horror, sprouting from a multiplicity of chins. Simon Templeton's, by contrast, was black and sharply pointed. A beak of a nose and icy blue eyes made the Knight of 9 Stars look like some elegant bird of prey. His doublet displayed 9 black stars within a golden saltire. Young Lord Hunter's ermine cloak confused her till she spied the brooch that pinned it. 5 silver arrows fanned. Elaine would have put his age closer to 50 than to 40. His father had ruled at Longbow Hall for nigh on 60 years, only to die so abruptly that some whispered the new lord had hastened his inheritance. Hunter's cheeks and nose were red as apples, which bespoke a certain fondness for the grape. She made certain to fill his cup as often as he emptied it. The youngest man in the party had 3 ravens on his chest, each clutching a blood-red heart in its talons. His brown hair was shoulder-length. 1 stray lock curled down across his forehead. "Sir Lynn Corbray," Elaine thought, with a wary glance at his hard mouth and restless eyes. Last of all came the Royces, Lord Nestor and Bronze Yon. The Lord of Runestone stood as tall as the hound. Though his hair was grey and his face lined, Lord Yon still looked as though he could break most younger men like twigs in his huge, gnarled hands. His seamed and solemn face brought back all of Sansa's memories of his time at Winterfell. She remembered him at table, speaking quietly with her mother. She heard his voice booming off the walls when he rode back from a hunt with a buck behind his saddle. She could see him in the yard, a practice sword in hand, hammering her father to the ground and turning to defeat Sir Roderick as well. "He will know me. How could he not?" She considered throwing herself at his feet to beg for his protection. He never fought for Rob. Why should he fight for me? The war is finished, and Winterfell has fallen. "Lord Royce," she asked timidly, "will you have a cup of wine to take the chill off?" Bronze John had slate-grey eyes half-hidden beneath the bushiest eyebrows she had ever seen. They crinkled when he looked down at her.
"Do I know you, girl?"
Elaine felt as though she had swallowed her tongue, but Lord Nestor rescued her.
"Elaine is the Lord Protector's natural daughter,"
he told his cousin gruffly.
"Littlefinger's Littlefinger
has been busy," said Lynn Corbury, with a wicked smile. Belmore laughed, and Elaine could feel the colour rising in her cheeks.
"How old are you, child?"
asked Lady Wainwood.
4 and 14, my lady."
For a moment she had forgotten how old Elaine should be.
"And I'm no child, but a maiden flowered."
"But not deflowered, one can hope."
Young Lord Hunter's bushy moustache hid his mouth entirely.
"Yet,"
said Lynn Corbury, as if she were not there. "But ripe for plucking soon, I'd say."
"Is that what passes for courtesy at heart's home?"
Anya Wainwood's hair was greying, and she had crow's feet round her eyes and loose skin beneath her chin. But there was no mistaking the air of nobility about her.
"The girl is young and gently bred, and has suffered enough horrors. Mind your tongue, sir."
"My tongue is my concern," Corbury replied.
"Your ladyship should take care to mind her own. I've never taken kindly to chastisement, as any number of dead men could tell you."
Lady Wainwood turned away from him.
"Best take us to your father, Elaine. The sooner we are done with this, the better."
"The Lord Protector awaits you in the solar, if my lords would follow me." From the crescent chamber they climbed a steep flight of marble steps that bypassed both undercrofts and dungeons and passed beneath 3 murder holes, which the Lord's declarant pretended not to notice. Belmore was soon puffing like a bellows, and Redford's face turned as grey as his hair. The guards atop the stairs raised the portcullis at their coming.
"This way, if you please, my lords."
Elaine led them down the arcade past a dozen splendid tapestries. Sir Lothar Brune stood outside the solar. He opened the door for them and followed them inside. Peter was seated at the trestle table, with a cup of wine to hand, looking over a crisp white parchment. He glanced up as the Lord's declarant filed in.
"My lord, be welcome. And you as well, my lady. The ascent is wearisome, I know. Please be seated. Elaine, my sweet, more wine for a noble guest."
"As you say, father."
The candles had been lighted, she was pleased to see. The solar smelled of nutmeg and other costly spices. She went to fetch the flagon, whilst the visitors arranged themselves side by side, all save Nestor Royce, who hesitated before walking around the table to take the empty chair beside Lord Peter and Lynn Corbury, who went to stand beside the hearth instead. The heart-shaped ruby in the pommel of his sword shone redly as he warmed his hands. Elaine saw him smile at Sir Lothar Brune.
"Sir Lynn is very handsome for an older man," she thought, "but I do not like the way he smiles."
"I've been reading this remarkable declaration of yours," Peter began. "Splendid. Whatever maester wrote this as a gift for words, I only wish you had invited me to sign as well."
That took them unawares.
"You?"
said Belmore.
"Sign? I will de Quill, as well as any man, and no one loves Lord Robert more than I do. As for these false friends and evil counsellors, by all means, let us root them out. My lords, I am with you, heart and hand. Show me where to sign, I beg you."
Elaine, poring, heard Lynn Corbury chuckle. The others seemed at a loss, till Bronze Jan Royce cracked his knuckles and said,
"We do not come for your signature, nor do we mean to bandy words with you, little finger."
"What a pity, I do so love a nicely banded word." Peter set the parchment to one side.
"As you wish, let us be blunt. What would you have of me, my lords and ladies?"
We will have naught of you."
Simon Templeton fixed the Lord Protector with his cold blue stare.
"We will have you gone."
"Gone?"
Peter feigned surprise. Where would I go?
The crown has made you Lord of Harrenhal,
young Lord Hunter pointed out.
That should be enough for any man.
The Riverlands have need of a lord,
old Horton Redford said.
River Run stands besieged. Bracken and Blackwood are at open war, and outlaws roam freely on both sides of the Trident, stealing and killing as they will. Unburied corpses litter the landscape everywhere you go.
You make it sound so wonderfully attractive, Lord Redford,
Peter answered. But as it happens, I have present duties here, and there is Lord Robert to consider. Would you have me drag a sickly child into the midst of such carnage?
His lordship will remain in the Vale, declared Jan Royce.
I mean to take the boy with me to Runestone, and raise him up to be a knight that John Aaron would be proud of.
Why Runestone? Peter mused. Why not Arnoaks or the Red Fort? Why not Longbow Hall?
Any of these would serve as well, declared Lord Belmore, and his lordship will visit each in turn in due time.
Will he? Peter's tone seemed to hint at doubts. Lady Waynewood sighed.
Lord Peter, if you think to set us one against the other, you may spare yourself the effort. We speak with one voice here. Runestone suits us all. Lord Jan raised three fine sons of his own. There is no man more fit to foster his young lordship. Mr. Heddywig is a good deal older and more experienced than your own Mr. Coleman, and better suited to treat Lord Robert's frailties. In Runestone, the boy will learn the arts of war from strong Sam Stone. No man could hope for a finer master-at-arms. Septon Lucas will instruct him in the matters of the spirit. At Runestone he will also find other boys his own age, more suitable companions than the old women and sellswords that presently surround him.
Peter Baelish fingered his beard. His lordship needs companions, I do not disagree. Elaine is hardly an old woman, though. Lord Robert loves my daughter dearly. He will be glad to tell you so himself. And as it happens, I have asked Lord Grafton and Lord Lindeley to send me each a son to ward, each of them as a boy of an age with Robert. Lynn Corbury laughed.
Two pops from a pair of lapdogs.
Robert should have an older boy about him, too. A promising young squire, say. Someone he could admire and try to emulate. Peter turned to Lady Waynewood. You have such a boy at Arnoaks, my lady. Perhaps you might agree to send me Harold Harding. Anya Waynewood seemed amused.
Lord Petrie, you are as bold a thief as I'd ever care to meet.
I do not wish to steal the boy, said Peter, but he and Lord Robert should be friends. Bronze Jan Royce leaned forward.
It is meet and proper that Lord Robert should befriend young Harry, and he shall, at Runestone under my care, as my ward and squire.
Give us the boy, said Lord Belmore, and you may depart the Vale unmolested for your proper seat at Harrenhal. Peter gave him a look of mild reproach.
Are you suggesting that elsewise I might come to harm, my lord?
I cannot think why. My late wife seemed to think this was my proper seat.
Lord Baelish, Lady Waynewood said, Lysa Tully was John Aaron's widow and the mother of his child, and ruled here as his regent. You, let's be frank, you are no Aaron, and Lord Robert is no blood of yours. By what right do you presume to rule us?
Lysa named me Lord Protector, I do seem to recall. Young Lord Hunter said,
Lysa Tully was never truly of the Vale, nor had she the right to dispose of us.
And Lord Robert, Peter asked, will your lordship also claim that Lady Lysa had no right to dispose of her own son?
Nestor Royce had been silent all this while, but now he spoke up loudly.
I once hoped to win Lady Lysa myself.
as did Lord Hunter's father and Lady Anya's son. Corbury scarce left her side for half a year. Had she chosen any one of us, no man here would dispute his right to be the Lord Protector. It happens